This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at weightwatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.
Were you ever not in school?
Yeah, that's exactly what my husband says. He said that I was really a professional funny. Student. Yeah, this is...
This is a special bonus episode. It's open to all because it's so important. It's an interview I did about the Israeli elections with Deanna Boutu, who is a Palestinian-Canadian lawyer and former advisor to Palestinian negotiators. She's also a policy advisor to the Palestinian Policy Network. She talks to me about her latest piece for The Nation, which is called The Israeli Elections Are a Referendum on Who Can Treat Palestinians Most Harshly. As listeners may know, there were Israeli elections on September 17th. Israel's former army chief, Benny Gantz, has declared victory over Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Gantz's Blue and White Party has two more parliamentary seats than Netanyahu's Likud party, and Gantz has rejected Netanyahu's call for a power-sharing agreement. Please rate and review The Katie Halper Show on iTunes. Also, become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. For some great Patreon-only episodes that I'll be releasing, one is a short little thing where I talk about Liz Warren and the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. It's kind of comedic. And another one is an interview with journalist Max Blumenthal, Anya Parampil, and Ben Norton. So thank you so much for talking to me.
My pleasure.
You have a great piece in The Nation called The Israeli Elections Are a Referendum on Who Can Treat Palestinians Most Harshly. While Netanyahu's talk of annexing parts of the West Bank caused a flurry, the reality is that few parties would oppose it. And you wrote that September 16th, so that was right before the elections?
Yes, one day.
Can you talk to us about any thoughts that you have before we can kind of dig into the article, but any thoughts that you have based on the election results?
Yes, definitely. You know, what's been interesting is everybody's focused on who the winner is, and a lot of pundits saying whether it's Netanyahu or Gantz. And in reality, we know who the loser is, and the loser is Palestinians. The loser is Palestinians because we know that both of these major parties, and in fact, all of the parties that were running for election with one exception, all of them believe in settlements. All of them believe in supporting some version or another of Israel taking Palestinian land. All of them believe in bombing Gaza. So it doesn't really matter who has actually won this election, because for Palestinians who are living here, the reality is going to be the same. We woke up on September 18th to still an occupation, and we're going to see this occupation continue for a very long time, unless and until there's pressure that is exerted on Israel to actually end it through the form of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. So that's been the thing that's been most striking, is that there's an entire conversation that is happening with the people who are the most affected by who's elected, not even engaged in that conversation. We're not even a footnote in that conversation that is happening. It's just this looking at it from the perspective of who has won in terms of these political parties, and not really looking at people and what that means.
Right. And there's this discussion that presents Benny Gantz as a kind of moderate, the non-Trumpian Israeli option. And as you point out in your article, the election was really Trump versus Trump. And you write, even the much lauded Benny Gantz launched his campaign in January by bragging about how, as Israel's military chief, he had bombed parts of Gaza to the Stone Age, a reference to the devastating 2014 Israeli military assault that decimated the besieged Gaza Strip. Netanyahu, of course, has been Netanyahu, declaring on Facebook last week that Arabs are trying to annihilate us and warning that should the left wing win, the only way it will be able to form a government is by forging a coalition with the Arabs, in quotes, the Arabs. So there does seem to be a difference in optics that we see a lot in U.S. politics, too, that I think can sometimes distract from the substantive similarity.
Yes.
Is that an accurate assessment of the Gantz-Netanyahu difference?
Yes, definitely. So, you know, the reason that there is this perception is because Netanyahu is so closely aligned with Trump. And in fact, his campaign, most of his ad campaign was a picture of him standing side by side with Trump, with it written in Hebrew saying Netanyahu, a different league, meaning that he and Trump are in the same league.
Right.
And so for the outsider who is looking at this, they would say, all right, Netanyahu is the Trump candidate. And he very much is. I don't want to deny him that honor.
Right.
Yes, he's very much the Trump candidate. But and the reason that people were focused so much on Gantz is that Gantz actually stayed fairly quiet during this election. When he did speak, it was very much against Palestinians in terms of how much he was going to crush us, etc. But he never brought up the issue of Trump. So for the person who's sitting in the United States who may be very critical of somebody like Netanyahu, Gantz appears to be a good alternative. The problem is that you need to have some sort of denial of reality to be able to believe that, because on all of the major issues relating to Palestinians, they are exactly the same. In fact, when Netanyahu announced that he was going to annex parts of the West Bank, all of the West Bank, but starting with the Jordan Valley, it was Gantz who came out and said, oh, finally, he's come to his senses. This is the plan that we had put out many, many years ago. So it's not like there is any difference between the two. Also, when it comes to the issue of racism, one thing that is true about Trump is that he's very overtly racist. Those statements that he made were the ones that he made before elections. You should have heard the stuff that he said on election day. Everything from the Arabs are voting in droves, his son tweeting out a picture of some voters in Turkey and saying, look how many Arabs there are voting. Please go out and rush to vote. And then later coming out and saying, if you don't want to see an Arab sitting here in these seats, meaning as ministers, then please vote for Likud. Gantz, on the other hand, while his rhetoric isn't as openly racist, he has the same position. He's the same person who has supported the nation state bill. This is the bill that enshrines the supremacy of Israel's Jewish citizens over its Palestinian or non-Jewish citizens. And he also has said that he will never form a coalition with any of the Arab parties. Not that we want to form a coalition with him either, because we don't want to be a government of occupation. But, you know, but the sentiment of him feeling that he needs to express that and say that he doesn't want any Arabs in his cabinet is also the same. So you really have to put blinders on in order to not see the similarities between the two, because they are virtually identical. In the words of the Palestinian prime minister, it's the difference between Coke and Pepsi. They're both the same.
And both really bad for you.
And both very bad for you. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
But have a lot of PR. All these headlines are kind of making it, like you said in your piece, you say that people are talking about it like it's a referendum on democracy. And you say?
Oh, I say it's not a referendum on the occupation, which is what it should be.
So despite the talk of this election as a referendum on democracy, then what is perhaps most notable is the lack of substantive choice. This is not a referendum on Israel's military rule over millions of disenfranchised Palestinians in the occupied territories, its cruel and illegal siege on Gaza, or its racist policies towards Palestinian citizens of Israel. Rather, it is, for Palestinians in particular, a choice between, as we said before, Trump versus Trump. As in substance, the major parties' policies are virtually indistinguishable. You were a negotiator, right?
Yes.
Can you talk about that experience and how much that may change your view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Yes, definitely. It depends on how many days you have for me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'll just go. I'll leave the recorder on. I'll go for a walk. Yeah. come back.
So, you know, I moved to Palestine young, virtually newly out of law school, and very much of the mindset that this was just a question of getting a legal agreement, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, and that's the end of it. And it was a very rude awakening, and very much a very much a learning experience to realize that wasn't what was happening. And a lot of that was because I was somebody who's reading the mainstream newspaper, right. And I thought that this was just, I thought that their reporting was exactly what was happening on the ground. And I later realized that they were certainly reporting one side, which was the way that Israelis perceived things, but not at all focused on the actual reality of more settlements going up, more checkpoints going up, Palestinians being denied the very basics, a blockade on Gaza, which began even before Hamas was ever elected, a decade before Hamas was ever elected. And these were the things that started to pull at me. And plus, being in the negotiations, that's when you saw the, at least for me, I saw the raw power and how power operates. So, for example, and this, by the way, was with a labor government, the so-called, you know, left-wing government. I remember at one point in time, there was a map that the Israelis presented with a redrawing of the green line so that Israel would take some major Israeli settlements, including the major settlement of Ariel, which is, you know, is almost 30 kilometers into the West Bank, like 20 miles into the West Bank. And it, so just right smack in the heart of the West Bank. And during those negotiations, I said to one of the negotiators, you know, explain to me on what basis of international law are you redrawing this line? And he chuckled and he said, I'm going to respect international law when I'm forced to respect it. Until that time, it's just you and me in a room.
Wow.
And that was that. That was,
he's honest.
Yeah, he was very honest. And again, this is somebody who describes himself as a lefty.
Right.
And so that it was those episodes that really began to sink in for me that what Israel was very much interested in was the illusion of a peace process, but that it didn't actually want to ever end the occupation. And they still have that today. You'll still hear today that so many Israeli politicians or Israelis will say, yes, we believe in there should be something, some negotiations with Palestinians. But then when you press them on, well, why does it take a Palestinian for you to end your occupation? Or what does ending the occupation look like to you? They can't describe it because they've conditioned themselves to believe that the settlements are part of Israel and that it is their right to continue to hold on to those settlements. And so that process for me was not only very jarring, but also very eye-opening and informative. And it now, having gone through it, I can see exactly where what is motivating Israel and how there's a very deliberate attempt to try to cover up the occupation. And sadly, a lot of people have learned to close their eyes to the occupation. So Gaza, for example, an area that Israel continues to blockade and besiege and bomb, cutting off the electricity. There isn't a proper water supply there. All Israeli controlled. They don't allow cancer patients to get the necessary radiation equipment into Gaza, and they don't allow these patients out to get treatment. And this is all happening under Israel's watch. And it's a slow, death by a thousand cuts. And in some cases, not slow either. And yet, if you ask Israelis, they're completely immune to it or completely indifferent to it. If you talk about Gaza, it's like they roll their eyes or they justify what Israel's doing. And the idea that somebody can justify war crimes, it shows you exactly what's happened to this society, and that it wasn't the when I walked in, it wasn't a society that was different. It was the same. It's just that what I was reading was very different than what was on the ground.
So is that something you were negotiating? You were representing the PLO, right?
Yes.
Is that something you wouldn't do? Like the person that you are now, I mean, this is like a time travel question, but I guess it seems like you it really changed the way you see the situation. So absolutely. Is that something you would not do now?
I would never do it now.
Yeah.
I would never do it now. I would never do it now for a couple of reasons. First is because I no longer believe. But secondly, and I think the more important thing is that there was this idea that Palestinians have to negotiate with their oppressor is mm-hmm. something that I find actually quite repugnant. So these were not negotiations that were between equals. It was an oppressed people, really in many ways, just trying to get the oppressor to see us as humans. You know, I can relate story after story about being held up at Israeli checkpoints on the day of a negotiation session. Like there was a negotiation session and being with the senior negotiators and, you know, an 18-year-old soldier stopping that senior negotiator at a checkpoint because they could. And then mm-hmm. having to work all of these various channels to try to get this 18-year-old to release a very senior Palestinian negotiator so that they could go to a negotiation session. So at every step of the way, the Israelis were always showing us who was more powerful and who was in control, whether it was the statement about I'll respect law when I'm forced to, or right. being held up at checkpoints. It was always a power imbalance with Israel always trying to flex its muscles and show us just how strong it was.
And so when you were negotiating, that was for Arafat?
Yes.
And was that Rabin?
No, Rabin was assassinated. So this was the time of Ehud Barak was the now leftist. You know, now he's since joined one of the leftist parties, the so-called leftist party. So this is my point is if you have somebody like Ehud Barak, who's classified as a leftist. Ehud Barak oversaw the biggest surge of settlements in Israel's history, apart from Netanyahu. He's a person who ordered that Palestinians, including Palestinian citizens of Israel, be gunned down. If he's considered a dove, then I'd hate to see what a hawk is.
Yeah. Is there a danger in the Gantz victory? Because I know that like Tony Jutt, who died, the historian, I remember him writing a piece at the London or New York Review of Books when Netanyahu was elected, and he was kind of not celebrating, but he was saying that the silver lining was that so-called progressive American Jews were not going to be like PEPs, right? You know, the term PEP, mm-hmm. progressive except on Palestine, that PEPs were no longer going to be able to justify supporting Israel because Netanyahu was just objectively speaking a rabid right winger, you know, neo-fascist. Of course, he was wrong. But is there a danger that the Gantz victory will just be used to kind of whitewash Israel even more than it's being whitewashed now?
Yeah, definitely. You know, PEPs will always be PEPs, no matter what,
right.
what
PEPs
happens.
PEPs gonna PEP, yeah.
Yeah, and so the only thing that Gantz does is that it allows the PEPs to feel a little bit smug. But, you know, one of the dangers in continuing to have Netanyahu in this role is it's difficult as a Palestinian who lives here to have to say that I want Netanyahu to win, or that I prefer Netanyahu because it will isolate the PEPs. In his period since he's been in office, we've seen the highest rate of settlement activity. We've seen the most racist statements. He's normalized racism in Israel, as you heard from some of the election campaigns. He's put in individuals who believe in ethnic cleansing in his cabinet. And he passed the nation state, the Jewish nation state law. He's done everything to incite hatred against Palestinians and to normalize hatred against Palestinians, even just within Israeli society. So the idea that I would want to see him over Gantz is horrifying. Now, is Gantz any better? No, clearly not. But I feel that the PEPs are going to be PEPs, And no matter who it is, just in the same way that I remember in the United States, people said with Bush being elected, it would wake people up and there would be this sudden awakening. It fortunately doesn't happen that way. These are processes, and we need to work and we need to educate people.
Right.
And
I mean, I just to clarify, I didn't mean that you were going
to
be.
No, I know.
Right.
Know,
it's
exactly.
more that like one of the surprising.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the. Yeah.
Totally get it. I totally get it. No, I think you're right. I mean, Gantz, the fear of Gantz is that it allows people to go back into snooze mode again.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And so instead of critiquing, Israel, there's this great phraseology, which is great, I'm saying in a bad sense. There's a terrible phraseology that's called Netanyahu's Israel, as though the adjective Netanyahu is what's defining Israel rather than just Israel. I mean, Israel is bad, no matter who the prime minister is.
Yeah.
And so getting rid of the adjective is the fear that they don't have to focus on the noun Israel. They just have to focus on getting rid of the adjective Netanyahu's Israel.
Right.
And that's
which we see with Trump here, right?
Exactly. Trump's
and
America.
People longing for the days of George Bush.
Yes.
HW, which is pretty scary. Now, there does seem to be a parallel between Trump's language. Obviously, he really does say racist things. I mean, it's an understatement, and you mentioned this. So is Gantz going to be someone whose policies are racist and destructive, but whose discourse won't be at that level?
I think so. I think that I think that he's going to be, you know, it's hard to say.
Right.
What I can say is, the reason I'm saying it's hard to say is that he ran a very quiet campaign.
Right.
And his campaign was very much just a picture of him with a few words that said, a unity, secular government. That's it.
Mm.
And he didn't give tons of interviews. He didn't say a whole lot. And so it's hard to judge by how he's going to speak when he's in office.
Right. So. I guess secular is an attempt to position himself as the more like evolved, enlightened option.
Yes. So trying to do away with some of the religious, some of the things like encouraging more transportation on Saturdays,
right,
and you know, that kind of stuff.
Like,
he's not looking at secular in the sense of a government for that where there's the separation of of the church and state or synagogue and state,
right?
But more in the sense of let's just open things up a little bit more.
Yeah, not being as orthodox, accommodating.
Right.
And what is it that you want people to know about and be aware of that they're not getting from the mainstream or so-called liberal press? And what do you recommend for good sources of media?
You know, there's the traditional, I'll use traditional and non-traditional cases rather than a traditional feminist. So there's the traditional way of reporting, and the traditional way of reporting is about looking at diplomatic events and building a story around a diplomatic event. Netanyahu went, Netanyahu came, Abu Mazen or Mahmoud Abbas went, there was this meeting. And that's what a lot of the reporting is, and viewed in that framework, you don't understand what life is actually like for Palestinians. And so the other way of reporting is the reporting where you're seeing what life is like for people who are living on the ground and who are suffering under Israel's military occupation. So oftentimes what I find very frustrating is people say to me, yeah, but you know, it's gone on for 52 years. And my response is, yes, it's gone on for 52 years. Imagine the weight of that. Imagine how heavy that is and what 52 years means. 52 years means more than one generation.
Mm-hmm.
52 years means that people haven't seen a day of the vast majority of people have not seen a day of freedom in their lifetime. 52 years means that there's an entire generation that has only ever lived behind checkpoints, behind a wall, who doesn't know what it's like to be able to have 3G on a cell phone. They don't know what it's like to not witness a home demolition. There's an entire 10 grades of one school that they don't know what it's like to not live without the threat of their school being demolished. And so for people who just look at the number as though it's somehow a boring, this boring number that's just repetitive, they don't really understand what the repetitiveness has meant and what life is actually like living under occupation, what life is actually like to not have electricity, to not have fresh water, to not be able to get medical treatment, to your kid never being able to see the sunset or go to the beach if you're in the West Bank. These are the realities that where dreams are so simple for a child in Gaza, their dream is to be able to go to Jerusalem, which is only 80 kilometers away, and a child in the West Bank, their dream is to be able to go to the sea, which is only less, 20 kilometers away. And these are the things that people don't report about because they're too busy reporting about the person went, the person had a meeting, et cetera. And so that's the stuff that for me, as I mentioned earlier on, I felt like I had been duped. I felt like I knew the ins and outs of every single meeting, but I didn't know what it was like for a Palestinian farmer to see their olive grove set aflame virtually every year as settlers are trying to deny them their one source of livelihood.
It reminds me kind of the like history from below versus the official history, or like, Howard's Inn.
Exactly.
The way it's, focusing on the lived experiences versus the interactions and contracts and, treaties of the elite, powerful, non-representative, alleged representatives.
Exactly.
And also, you hear this refrain, I hear it so much about, well, the Israelis offered this and then the Palestinians refused. So what do you expect? I mean, there's like a distortion of diplomatic history.
Yes.
But it's also this emphasis on diplomatic history allows Israel apologists to hide behind that as if it's the fault of all Palestinians that there was some negotiation that they see as bad.
Well, and also it's this idea that it's Israel's to offer. That's the problem.
Yeah.
And when you start from the premise that this is Israel's land to offer to the Palestinians rather than Palestinian land that is being rightfully going back to Palestinians. It's a different way of framing. And the problem is that there's this not only a notion of generosity, but then an ability
and charity,
but then an ability to collectively punish. And that's what it's like to live as a Palestinian, is that we are always under the system of collective punishment. So when Netanyahu says that he won't be in a government with the Arabs, this is what exactly he's talking about, is that we're not individuals. We're just this one mass of people. And, so it's what's interesting to me now is as we're standing at this moment, what was for me the most interesting about this election, to bring it back to the election, was that there's one political party which is called the Joint List. It's the only anti-Zionist political party which has both Palestinians and Israelis on their list. That ended up getting votes not only from Palestinian Arab voters, but also from Jewish Israeli voters. And that it's now looking as the only real opposition inside Israel, because it's an opposition that believes in equality. It's an opposition that doesn't believe in the denial of freedom. It's an opposition that wants to see it, that is pushing for an end to the occupation, pushing for an end to Israel's bombing campaigns. And this is now the fact that this is the alternative, and that it's an anti-Zionist political party that is pushing this alternative, says a lot about where we are now. While the Israeli ministers are homophobic and transphobic and misogynists and routinely Photoshop out women, women from their from the pictures of the cabinet, right? The Palestinian MKs are the opposite. They're the ones who are pushing for LGBTQ rights. They're the ones who are pushing for women's rights alongside fighting the day-to-day grind of anti-Palestinianism and Islamophobia. And so that's for me the...
Well, that's interesting. I should do an episode on that.
Yeah, that's for me where I see things that are interesting is that you have much of Israeli society... much of the Israeli political parties bunched into that other category of racist,
right,
homophobic, etc. And then you see this the real alternative, and it's not at all coincidental that the real alternative is an alternative that is also has at its core pushing for Palestinian freedom and equality.
Yeah, because of course there's that narrative that it's like, you know, the enlightened Israeli society versus these like barbarians, and there's so much pinkwashing.
Yes.
So do you think if, let's say, Gantz is less overtly racist, less racist in his discourse, will that be an improvement at all?
Yes.
Will that make life? Okay.
Yes, it will make life. I don't want to turn it into like it's going to be life changing, but it will make life
right.
Definitely a little bit better. I can tell you just from personal experiences living here that there are times where I'm afraid to speak Arabic in public places, where I've actually been told to stop speaking Arabic in public places, and where there's so much anti-Arab racism. It's frightening. It's really frightening. And I'm somebody that they can't tell if I'm Arab or Jewish. They can't tell if I'm Christian or Muslim. They can't tell. And if I feel that, you can just imagine what it's like for people, for others.
Right. Who
are visibly Muslim.
Right.
Or visibly Christian, who are wearing a Christian a cross on their neck,
right?
And this is it's become so fashionable, and for Israel to be racist that they don't even think twice about it. And the fact that, for example, President Obama said something against Netanyahu in the 2015 election when he said the Arabs are voting in droves.
Right,
and that made Obama made Netanyahu pause for a little bit. This time around, he said the exact same thing.
Yeah,
and nobody came forward—not Trump, not anybody—and said,
right, of course,
"Wow,
yeah.
This is shocking." And not only did nobody from the United States, nobody within Israel found it shocking either.
Mm.
And that's the scary part: is that it's become so normalized,
right,
that it's. It's not easy living here. And so if Gantz's rhetoric is less, that'll be an improvement.
Right.
This isn't going to be earth-shattering, but
sure, right.
At least, and it's not going to obviously take away the racism. It's still there.
Right.
But there's something to be said for elected officials who are espousing hate, as you all know, in the United
right.
States, versus those who don't.
Right. So it seems like what your point is like, yeah, there will be a difference, but it's not the difference that the American media or Israel apologists or PEPs are pretending it will be.
Exactly. Exactly.
No. Not to play into the diplomatic history critique, but what was Arafat like?
He was a complex figure. He was somebody who... I don't know how to. I don't want to be a revisionist because he made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
And at the same time, having worked with both him and the current president, there was a difference between the two of them. So he was somebody who he very much, very naively, by the way, very much believed in when you give your word, it mm-hmm. means your word.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the Oslo negotiations. There were a lot of it was a lawyer's nightmare. There were a lot of gaps in all the various agreements. And it was mostly because Yitzhak Rabin had said to him, if I put this in writing, the Knesset is never going to improve it. So, but you know, you and I, we're on the same page. And, yeah. And Arafat very much believed that. So he very much like clung to that. So even after Rabin's death, or assassination, he would often repeat these things. And it was sort of akin to people sort of saying to him, like, yes, wake up. But
right.
He said it, but he didn't believe it. And he said it and he did the exact opposite. But he had this sort of stubborn way of very much believing in people because they had, because they shook hands.
Yeah.
So he was that. He was also, he also had a wicked memory. And he was very charismatic. Like, he's the type of person that if he walked into the room, you could feel that he walked into the room
right.
without even looking. You could feel his presence in the room. With me, he was very much like a grandfather. He was always concerned that everybody was well fed, well rested,
yeah. right.
You know, very very grandfatherly. He also had his flaws. He could be stubborn to a fault, and like a lot of leaders, an egomaniac to a fault, and so he was all to say he was complicated. He was a very complicated, rich in the sense not financial,
right.
rich, and in fact he was quite poor financially. Like
oh really?
Yeah, he wore. Gosh, you know, the boots he wore were probably about 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
Clothing he wore was always very old. He himself was not corrupt, but he corrupted people. So he definitely knew how to spend money on people, and if he thought that it was going to do something good for Palestine, he would invest
right.
in it. But not so much on himself.
Mm. And how did you become a negotiator? And what brought you to that? I mean, you grew up in Canada, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, what was your trajectory besides, as we mentioned before, a lot of education?
Oh, this is another long story. So I grew up in a household that was political, but political focused on Canada. And not so much on Palestine. My parents really, I think, wanted to shield me from what it's like to be, they were Palestinian citizens of Israel. My father lived through the Nakba. He was kicked out of his home at the age of 9 and his town destroyed, never to go back. And then lived under an apartheid system from the time that he was 9 until the time he left the country when he was in his late 20s. And so for him and for my mother, I think they saw Canada as a refuge of sorts and didn't really want to live through that turmoil and through that trauma any longer. So so that was the household that I was raised in. And it was when the first Intifada started that I was moved to learn more about Palestine, go to Palestine. I was young, but to learn more about Palestine, to go to Palestine, to witness
How
Palestine.
Old were you?
Oh, I was probably about 15.
Okay. 16. And you spoke Arabic in your...
No.
Oh.
I didn't speak Arabic.
So you didn't know Arabic when you
went? Didn't know Arabic. And suddenly was confronted with the Intifada. And I didn't know what that was about. And felt very ignorant, so I did what I've done best in my life, which is I studied and learned Arabic, learned about Palestine through people, and obviously through books, but through people. And that really prompted me to want to do something for Palestine. And I remember as a child saying, I always wanted to be a doctor, and then after my visit to Palestine saying that I want to be a lawyer and I want to do something for Palestine. And then there was kind of no looking back. So after I finished university and then law school and was in doing grad school. During that period, I had spent a lot of time visiting Palestine and volunteering. But I was very much in this lull that, although, because the negotiations had taken place, were taking place. And so I thought, with negotiations underway, all of the stuff that I was seeing, like all of the harm and the damage that I was seeing, I duped myself into believing that all of that could be magically undone with these, with negotiations. So, for example, when I came to Palestine in the summer of 96, I remember seeing many more settlements than I had seen the years before and thinking, oh, it's okay, they'll all go away. And then I remember being in a taxi, and because I had a Canadian passport, I was allowed to continue on in the taxi, but people, Palestinian men, were taken out of the taxi and forced to wait in the sun. And I used to think, oh, you know, it's okay, all of this will be, it'll all go away with the negotiations. So I had to be one of these people who, like the Peps, you know, said, oh, it's just, it's all going to go away if just this one little, if these negotiations just succeed.
Right.
And so when I was presented with the opportunity to work as a lawyer on the negotiations, this came through some of the work that I had done as an intern and a volunteer at a number of organizations. When the opportunity presented itself, I said yes. Mm. And I said yes and thought that it was going to be just for a short period of a year. I arrived the second day, the first day of the second intifada, which was September of 2000, and stayed. Mm. And stayed because it very much shook me. Like, living through the intifada, the first, for example, the first 3 days of the intifada, Israel killed 50 Palestinians. And I just felt like there was no way that I could turn, you know, like not bear witness any longer and pretend that it didn't happen. So that was, that's what took me there.
And what are you doing now? You live in Haifa and Ramallah. You said you go back and forth?
Yes, I go back and forth. And I work as a legal consultant. So doing a lot of legal research, and I'm an analyst and I write.
I mean, I can cut this out because it's a personal question, but I'm just curious. Do you have kids?
I have one son, five.
What's it like raising a child there? Is there a lot of like...
It's the most... I don't know if you have children.
Mm-mm.
So being a parent is... It's a process of learning to cope with your constant doubt.
Right.
It's like, because you doubt yourself on everything. Am I being too lenient? Am I being too harsh? Am I allowing too much sugar? Am I, you know, so you're always in self-doubt. Add to that I'm raising my son in an environment that is openly racist.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I do that? How do I teach him to respond to some of the racism? And we experience it, by the way, almost daily.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Almost daily.
How he experiences it.
Daily. So his name is, which is a very Muslim name.
Right.
And he's blonde.
Uh-huh.
So the number of times that I've heard people say, oh, what's your son's name? Because they hear us speaking English. They hear me say, and when I tell them his name is, the response is always, he doesn't look like an
right.
Or, and I said, well, really, well, what's supposed to look like, right? And it's this, so and I always question myself, am I giving the right response? Am I saying the right thing? Because he's within earshot. Or what is he internalizing by what an should look like?
Right.
And so, you know, so it's self-doubt that becomes even more heightened living in a place that's racist, because I'm always asking myself, should I be living here, or should I go to Canada, given that I have the privilege of being able to leave?
Right.
And it's the daily question that I ask myself, and not to say that Canada is better.
Right, paradise.
As we saw today with the prime right. minister.
Yeah, congrats.
Yes, exactly. So not to say that Canada is better on the racist front. The difference is that I think here the challenge is that I want him to understand what it right. means to be an activist who is against apartheid, against racism, and opposed to occupation, and who's striving for, who wants to see freedom.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, like every mother wants just a normal, happy childhood for their child. And that's what pulls me mm-hmm. each and every day. Add to that, I don't know if you've ever been here, but Israel has these, they have a series of sirens that they blare mostly around the Jewish holidays. And my son, who's 5, asks the questions all the time. Why are the sirens going off? And the sirens are, by the way, are not warning sirens. These are commemoration sirens. And the thing that I struggle with is that he's from this land and he was born here and he's made to feel as though he's an outsider, an interloper. And that it's a state that, you know, also like other states, that in many cases, in many ways worships power and might and militarism.
Yeah,
and I struggle with that.
Does he ask questions?
All the time,
yeah.
All the time. When we go through checkpoints, he asks why there's checkpoints. When he sees the 25-foot-high wall, he asks why there's a wall. He also asks about why there's graffiti on the wall.
Yeah.
He asks about why there's so many people carrying guns.
Mm.
He asks why there's army. Because kids don't... They don't understand. I don't think we understand why they're
so much. But they're not used to it.
They're not used to it.
He can
sense hostility, and he asks why people are mean.
Mm-hmm.
And
when you mentioned the blonde thing, it reminded me of how Michael Oren suggested that, or just overtly lied about Taimi being.
Yeah, an implant.
An actor, like a family of actors, and that they don't even look Palestinian.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is my constant refrain. It's like I say that I can't believe something, and then like how many times are they going to do something ridiculous before I'm not going to be on some level surprised?
It's funny you say that because I say the same every day about Trump.
Yeah.
I say, there's no way. And then there's a way.
Yeah.
So that's the problem. Yeah. There's a way.
Your husband, because your husband, he's not Jewish, right?
No, he's not Jewish.
So that's not problematic because
Hugely problematic.
Oh, it is.
Hugely problematic. So we went through a process of 7 years of every 6 months having to prove that we were still married. You're going to love this story. So... So let me back up. I was born in Canada, but under Israeli law, one generation of children who are born to citizens of the state have citizenship. So I, by virtue of my parents, have citizenship. And so I got citizenship upon birth, but not by virtue of being born here because of my parents. What my husband, on the other hand, his father left Palestine in 49, I think it was, and moved to the United. He was living in different. He was living throughout the Arab world, and then moved to the United States, which is where he met his wife and married and 3 kids. When my husband and I got married, from the time that we got married until set for a full 7 years. We were in a process where every 6 months we had to continue to prove that we were still married. Now, how do you, the original, and the way that they think about it is it's that you have to disprove the negative. So they come in with the mindset that you are not married and you have to disprove that negative.
Right.
So so the first time that we went to get him a visa, the Israelis said, no, we don't believe that you're married. And they refused to give him a visa. They gave him a very short visa. And so what we then did, which they then renewed, to be fair. So they, in total, he had 6 months. What we did was for 6 months, we took a picture of ourselves.
Oh my God.
Three times a day. My husband's a former photojournalist. Three times a day, holding the newspaper, that day's newspaper. And so we, in front of a landmark in Haifa. So
right.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And at the end of 6 months, you just see my hair get longer, my That's face so get funny. More and more sour, the cat get fatter right. over the course of 6 months. And it was only that then allowed them to, that was the reason that they ended up granting him a longer term visa, was because we were constantly in this loop of showing them
right.
all of these
documenting
pictures.
It. Wow, you should do a guide to that for people.
Yes, we've actually talked about publishing our photos.
Because
they're well done.
That would be really good.
Publishing them and writing a little story about what that whole experience was like.
And what's going to be done or what needs to be done, do you think?
I think BDS is the way, boycott, divestment, sanctions. Israel's not going to change from within. It's just not a society that is... it's been the vast majority of Israelis have been conditioned through a process by they're militarized. Right. You see it as a very young child, where the army comes to your school. The days of celebrations are celebrations that they're celebrating the army and fighting.
Yeah.
And going to the army is very much seen as a rite of passage.
Right.
So kids are treated a certain way up until they're then sent into the army, and the army becomes that rite of passage when they, as Israelis will say, they get turned into a man or turned into a woman.
It's their second bar bat mitzvah.
Exactly. and so there are people who wake up and who say, I don't want to live in this reality. I don't want to serve in the army. I don't believe in denying another people their freedom. But it's people who really are working on themselves and trying to learn, and they're not getting their information from the mainstream Israeli press, believe me. So change is not going to come from within the society. It's going to come from outside. And it's when Israelis make that connection between their inability to go to parts of European countries without getting a visa. If you're, for example, a settler, you won't be given a visa to go into Europe. That or recognizing that companies are just not going to normalize. Israel's not going to be treated as a normal country.
Yeah.
That Israel's going to be sanctioned. That companies are going to pull out from Israel. That's the only way that they're going to see that connection between what's happening to what they're doing to Palestinians and then what the result is. And until that time, it's just going to continue. The occupation will continue in perpetuity because successive Israeli governments have done away with the Green Line. They've erased it. And so many Israelis don't even, I don't want to say they don't recognize they're going into the West Bank, but they, how do I put it? Like, they don't see that that's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when that is brought home to them and they're forced to pay a price that I think that we're going to see change happen one way or another.
And are you a fan of Amo Bernie's?
I definitely am. I definitely am. And I'm hoping that...
And that would be so great.
Yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, this is one of those other things, like at this point, that when you look at Trump, And you have one of two responses, like anybody would be better than Trump for those who are on the right-wing side of the Democrat Party.
Right.
And then you have other people who are saying, look, this is time for real change.
Yeah.
And so that's what, referring to the Israeli elections, that's exactly what's happened here, is that you've got Trump in office. Yeah. And then some people saying, well, let's get the right-wing branch of the other party. And then other people saying this is time for real change. And that's what the joint list is. And hopefully you'll see that change as well.
Well, yeah. Thank you again so much. My pleasure. What time is it where you are? It must be late, right?
Midnight. 20 minutes after midnight.
Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you so much. And I will email this to you. Yeah. It was really great talking to you. And I have faith you will come to...
To New York?
New York,
inshallah,
yes.
I hope so.
Yeah,
hope
inshallah, yeah. Ojalá, yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Talk
Thanks,
soon.
Thanks, Ayanna.
All right, take care.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye.